When you wonder, you're learning. Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids by Greg Bear and Ryan Rydowski. Forward by Joanne Rogers. Forward. Even by Pittsburgh's frigid November standards, it was cold out there. But I didn't mind very much, despite my inner Floridian. I was due that day to visit the neighborhood hospital, and though hospital visits aren't typically cause for cheer, least of all for little old ladies like me, I knew this one would be different. I knew this one would be special. I put on a cardigan, one of his, and zipped it against the chill. The hospital's atrium was already full. The room fell quiet as I pushed through the door, and someone sat down at the lobby's piano and played a familiar chord. Then, all at once, the doctors and nurses started to sing. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. What music! The old lyrics filled the lobby, sounding almost new. I stopped, as I always do, to sing along. Afterward, in the hospital nursery, I met the reason for my visit. Six newborn babies, all dressed in tiny red sweaters and little blue booties made to match my late husband's shoes. Six little Freds, brand new to the world, with so much to wonder and learn. I loved them from the moment we met. Maybe you saw the pictures. It was a big to-do staged to celebrate World Kindness Day and the 65th anniversary of WQED, the television station where Fred had made Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. The pictures made their way to the internet, and social media did what social media does. By the end of the day, the whole country loved those babies, and I think I knew why. Pittsburgh, you see, wasn't the only place that was cold that day. Half the nation had frozen solid. The front page of the New York Times said that in McAllen, Texas, temperatures fell from 92 degrees to just 31, all in a couple of hours. The other words on the page, eviction, hate crime, brutality, and Sandy Hook among them, said all there was to say about the temperature of everything else. It was November 13th, 2019, World Kindness Day, in a world where kindness is hard to find, where more and more people feel hardened and messed up, whether by politics or poverty or the ever-growing gulfs between our neighbors and ourselves. As Fred's wife of 51 years, I'm often asked what he'd think about this coldness that's crept across our country. And I always say the same thing. Fred Rogers would think first and foremost about the children. I think those tiny babies made us stop and do the same. I think they showed us that despite the cold, kindness and warmth can endure. Swaddled in their sweaters, they showed us that even though Fred had gone to heaven some time ago, he left us the neighborhood's blueprints. And we could rebuild it wherever we'd like, even in a hospital nursery on a frigid November day. In 1920, a Frenchman named Antoine de Saint-Exupéry enrolled at the Beaux-Arts School in Paris, hoping to become an architect. He dropped out before he finished his studies, but he learned enough about blueprints to pen the most memorable line in The Little Prince, a novella he published many years later. L'essentiel est invisible pour le use. Saint wrote, what is essential is invisible to the eye. Fred loved the Little Prince, and he loved that quote best of all. He loved it so much that he hung it in his office. Reading it now, Saint-Exupéry's quote puts me in mind of a house. We call an old house beautiful when its wood is polished and fine, when it's furnished with well-made things, when there's art on the walls and the gardens in bloom. But what's essential about the house is almost always hidden from view. We don't see the minds that dreamed it or the labor that built it. We don't see the nuts and bolts that brace it or the love that lives in its rooms. And if we ever want to rebuild it or add a modern wing, we have to grasp its design. We have to get into the crawl space and pull up the carpets and have a look at what's beneath. We have to go back to its blueprints. You might say the same of the neighborhood. So much of what made the program essential was invisible to the camera, built so carefully into Fred's scripts and songs that you'd never know it was there. When Fred put on a sweater at the start of each episode, we only knew that it made us feel safe. We never saw the hours he spent with scientists and teachers and experts in child development engineering that very feeling. When he took us to visit a factory, we only knew that we'd gone somewhere fun. We never saw it as part of a plan to nourish curiosity, encourage creativity, and show us that right down to our favorite crayons, the things we love about life come from our fellow neighbors. Grasping these intentions and the designs that helped Fred fulfill them is key to rebuilding the neighborhood. Lots of people are doing that now, each in their own way. People tell me that Fred is as popular today as he was when he was alive. And doesn't that make sense? Who better to turn to when kindness seems lacking than the kindest person we've known? Who better to beat back the cold than the man in a cardigan sweater? As his wife, of course, I find it marvelous. I sometimes say that I'm the luckiest widow in Pittsburgh. Every day I can be close to him. I can put on his old sweater or sing his old songs or meet adorable little babies in a nursery. I'm grateful, and when I consider the lives that my husband has touched, I'm grateful even more. But sometimes I worry. I worry that as the world grows meaner, kindness like Fred's can look less and less attainable. I worry we'll forget that Fred was just as human as we are. We'll forget that he sometimes has doubts, that he sometimes feels defeated, that he sometimes felt angry. We'll forget that he wasn't a saint. Don't get me wrong. Fred was the same in real life as he was on television. The Fred you saw in the neighborhood was the Fred you saw in the street and the Fred I saw at home. That's just who he was. Fred always gave his authentic self. I mean, only that was nothing magic about him. There was no miracles in the neighborhood. Everything you saw and everything you felt stemmed from his deliberate efforts and designs. He made kindness look easy, but even for Fred, kindness was anything but. Try your best to make goodness attractive, he'd like to say. That's one of the toughest assignments you'll ever be given. If we can say anything about my husband, it's that he accepted that assignment every hour of his life. No one worked harder at being Fred Rogers than Fred Rogers himself. I trust this won't diminish his aura. In my opinion, the extent of his effort only makes him more remarkable. But we ought to resist holding him up beyond the reach of us mortals, because the truth of Fred's ministry was that every last one of us can be as caring, kind, and influential in children's lives as he was. Every last one of us can do a version of what Fred did. That's why this book is so important, and why I'm so delighted that Greg and Ryan wrote it. When You Wonder, Your Learning explores what's essential about the neighborhood, making it visible to parents, teachers, and anyone else who cares about children. It breaks down the tools for learning that Fred taught and the reason they're still significant. It contains, in a very real sense, the blueprints my husband left us, and it introduces the people building neighborhoods of their own, places where kindness and warmth endure despite the cold that creeps outside. Places where children are cared for and safe, even when the wind kicks up and the temperature starts to fall. Back at the hospital that frigid November day, I asked the parents of those six beautiful babies if they were nervous to go home. Invariably, their answer was yes. Who could blame them? Beyond that nursery was parenthood, a state of astonishment, joy, and the nagging feeling that you're royally screwing it up. Even friendly advice can be nerve-wracking. Fred himself felt that too many tips led to anxiety and overthinking. So instead, I offer the simplest, truest thing I know. Being there for each other and supporting each other is what it's all about. This is a book about the many ways we can do that. Once in the 1970s, Fred asked me to appear on his program, just as I had a couple of times before. On cue, I knocked on his television door and crossed his make-believe threshold. I said I was happy to be back in the neighborhood again, and I was. I still am. It gives me a good feeling, Fred told his television neighbors, to know that I can be with her. Well, Fred, it gives me a good feeling to know that you're with us now, and those old sweaters of yours, and those six newborn babies, and in the six chapters of this beautiful book. Joanne Rogers, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, August 2020. Introduction: Trouble in the Neighborhood. On February 19, 1968, if you had turned to the National Educational Television Network, a sort of proto-PBS, you would have noticed a curious introduction to a program you've ever seen. After panning over a miniature model town, the camera settles in someone's living room. A tall, gawky young man strolls through the front door, singing a catchy, nonsensical tune about wanting to be your neighbor. He swaps his coat for a more comfortable sweater, changes his shoes, and leans towards the camera to speak to the nation for the very first time. His opening lines aren't exactly gripping. In fact, one of the first things he tells you is that it took him a long time to learn to tie his shoes. But I kept practicing and practicing and practicing, and finally I learned quickly, he says. There's some banter about a porch swing and the purpose of a ladder, and then he sings a song about liking you, yes, you, just the way you are. You wouldn't have known it then, but you just witnessed the TV debut of one of the most legendary teachers of all time. Nothing you'd seen on screen was haphazard or random. On the contrary, he'd engineered all of it, from his sweater to his porch swing to his song, for a particular purpose. And over the course of more than 900 of these television visits, as the host would come to call them, that purpose would gradually grow clear. Though today we tend to remember his gentle warmth and kindness, Fred Rogers was more than a nice guy in a cardigan. In fact, what made Mr. Rogers' neighborhood so effective in the first place was less to do with Fred Rogers, the television host, than it did with his ingenuous application of the learning sciences. An accomplished scholar in his own right, Rogers worked with the leading minds of his day, including world-famous pediatricians, psychologists, and child development experts, some of whom you'll meet in the following pages, to ensure that everything children saw in the neighborhood enriched their lives and nurtured their growth as human beings. Like all great teachers, Rogers used what he knew to captivate and even enchant his students. He blended the neighborhood science so seamlessly with his art, with its art, that it's all but invisible now. What looked like an inexpensive costume is instead a perfect conduit for curiosity. A strange sounding song lyric sends a message of self-acceptance. Rogers based every story, every song, every script on what had been proven to benefit children. If anything, he was almost too good at hiding the science behind the show. Today, his legacy as a scholar has largely been forgotten. It's doubtful, though, that Fred Rogers would have cared. What if you were offered an hour of television live every day? He once asked. Can you imagine what it's like to try to fill that up with something of value? I wanted to give the best I could. By all accounts, that's exactly what he did. From its 1968 debut until its final episode in 2001, The Neighborhood helped whole generations navigate rapid, sometimes unsettling change. It made millions of kids feel valued and loved, and in turn helped millions of kids value and love their neighbors. Studies of children who regularly watched the program found that compared to their peers, neighborhood viewers grew more patient, more playful, more cooperative, and more social. And of course, many of those children went on to raise children of their own. Fred Rogers' impact on the last half century is incalculable. But following his death in 2003, the neighborhood gradually disappeared from American airwaves, becoming a pleasant, if fading, memory of, in the minds of the children who watched it. With its cardigan-clad host, its distinctive Pittsburgh accents, and its dated special effects, The program can be seen, at least at first glance, hopelessly detached from the rest of modern media. It's slow, it's quiet, it's not exciting by design. And aside from some minor tweaks, it looked like the same neighbor. It looked the same at the end of as it had at the beginning. It's tempting to think the neighborhood fell behind the times. But perhaps we've gotten it wrong. Perhaps we've let the times drift away from the neighborhood. Clearly, there's still a cultural craving for what the program offered. Its animated spin-off, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, is streamed more than 40 million times per month. An acclaimed documentary, a best-selling biography, and a biopic starring Tom Hanks have all created a Mr. Rogers renaissance, one that highlights his unrelenting goodness in a world that seems to lack it. Amid the nostalgia and the good feelings and our reverence for Fred Rogers the man, all that's missing now is an exploration of what he did and how he did it and why it worked. Ourselves, 500 or 1,000 years ago. In a tiny town in Western Europe, the kids have taken over. They've swarmed the river and fields. They've climbed every tree and stormed every building. In the streets, chaos. Kids waddled on stilts, blow bubbles, and bang drums. They don homemade hats and strange wooden masks. They leapfrog through the alley, swinging sticks at piñatas and shaking their rattles with glee. And best of all, there's not an adult to be found, a childhood fantasy more than 4.5 centuries old. Artist Peter Bruegel the Elder's 1560 oil painting, Children's Games, is perhaps the Western world's most detailed window into what childhood looked like hundreds of years ago. Bruegel's encyclopedic work depicts more than 70 toys and games, nearly all of which children would recognize today. Though time-traveling tweens might recoil at the lack of Renaissance-era iPhones, they'd likely find solace in the game of King by Your League, Hide and Seek, or Sun and the Moon, Tug of War. They'd also find that their 16th century peers weren't nearly as alien as they might have expected. Historians of childhood have spent whole careers reconstructing the youths of past generations, digging for details in schoolmasters' reports, church records, diaries, parenting manuals, and more. What they found is that kids in other times and places were basically ourselves 500 or 1,000 years ago, writes the British scholar Nicholas Orme. While children's individual experiences have varied in every conceivable way, certain aspects of childhood are timeless and classic. Kids have always needed special care and special people to provide it. Parents and relatives, yes, but also, depending on the era, wet nurses, wizards, and witches. They've always crawled away behind their parents' backs, driven by the need to look, explore, and wonder. They've always reached for the sweetest food on the table, fought with and hugged their siblings and friends, and surprised and tested their teachers. And they've always grown up too fast and made lives of their own too soon. So it was in the Middle Ages, writes Orme, and for long before that. And so it was in Pittsburgh in 2007. At the time, Greg had just taken a new job as executive director of the Grable Foundation, a family philanthropy dedicated to improving children's lives. Ryan was a college student preparing to become a teacher. As we started down our respective paths, we talked with as many parents and educators as we could, asking each of them different versions of the same basic question: what do children need? It seems straightforward enough. In a very basic sense, all kids need the same things: food, shelter, safety, love. Given our vocations, we expected slightly more specific requests: extra help with fractions, funding for classroom computers, a new floor for the school gym. What we heard instead would change the course of our lives. We heard it from rookie teachers and classroom veterans. We heard it from progressive, reform-minded principals and old school librarians. We heard it from counselors, museum curators, parents, and grandparents. We're just not connecting with kids the way we used to. The details differed, but nearly everyone we spoke to felt a disconnect, as if something seismic had shaken childhood's foundation. At first, we chalked it up to that time-honored frustration, kids these days.
Such a feeling is nothing new. Generational hand-wringing might be our oldest tradition. A child-rearing tract from the Puritan era describes kids as vile and abject persons, liars, thieves, and evil beasts, and good for nothing. Anyone who works with or cares for children has a difficult, demanding job. But the more we listen, the more we realized adults' concerns went far beyond frustration. Their unease was philosophical, almost existential in nature. The people we spoke to had been among the first to detect a turning point, the moment the world's rate of change exceeded our ability to keep up. For the first time, a generation of kids had spent their entire lives online. Their relationships with peers, parents, and even themselves had been forged in ways the world had never seen. They'd been raised with the ability to communicate instantly with anyone, anywhere, anytime. The answer to almost anything they'd want to ask could be found in a matter of seconds. They could create and consume art with tools that, until recently, had been confined to science fiction. If Peter Bruegel the Elder had been around to recreate his famous painting, the modern version might largely consist of tiny glowing screens. Hence the disconnect between kids and adults. Kids were growing up in a world vastly different from our own. As adults, we'd yet to reconcile what's timeless and classic about childhood with the rapid ways the world had changed. But plenty of people were working on it, whether they knew it or not. Project Oxygen. In 2008, Google asked a team of statisticians to help solve a problem. Since the company's founding, its culture had been created and driven by software engineers, a breed famous for preferring computers to people, for wanting to be left alone, and for their zealous aversion to conventional office life. Not surprisingly, such a culture bred a distaste for hierarchy. When everyone is the smartest person in the room, who needs a boss? It's a dilemma the company had struggled with since its inception. In fact, for a brief period in 2002, Google eliminated engineering managers altogether, though the experiment fizzled when employees brought every issue, from the major to the trivial, to the company's co-founder, Larry Page. The company conceded that it needed managers, if only to keep things organized. Still, Google took a pretty simple approach to management, reported the New York Times. Leave people alone. Let the engineers do their stuff. If they become stuck, they'll ask their bosses, whose deep technical expertise propelled them into management in the first place. To validate that approach, the company asked its statisticians to determine once and for all which characteristics made for good bosses. Dubbed Project Oxygen, the multi-year initiative shocked the company. The statisticians collected and coded more than 10,000 data points from performance reviews, employee surveys, exit interviews, and more. Their analysis found that technical expertise, the ability, say, to write computer code in your sleep, ranked dead last, among the things that mattered most. The other more important skills included a boss's ability to communicate clearly and to take a collaborative approach to problem solving. More than anything else, Googlers craved an accessible manager who cared about employees and their well-being. It was an early lesson in what would matter as the digital age developed. One of the world's most powerful technology companies discovered the importance of human qualities above all else. To be sure, technical expertise was still important. But what Project Oxygen suggested, and what parents, educators, and researchers have since confirmed, is that today's kids need more than the ability to read, write, and do arithmetic. Tomorrow's thriving adults will be the people you can go to with problems, who can listen, ask questions, and help think through complex issues, who know how teams work, and who can nurture other people's strengths. They'll be endlessly curious and radically empathetic. They'll be, in other words, the type of people that Project Oxygen identified, people with qualities that can't be replaced by machines. We should pause here to say that by no means are we equating working at Google with living a successful life. The purpose of learning is far nobler than preparing future workers. It's about kids discovering their potential and their purpose, becoming more fully themselves. It's about raising creative, curious, caring neighbors and citizens, people who can build strong, more inclusive communities and a more just and loving world. Still, Google remains a useful example, if only because the company's core function, organizing and navigating the world's data, will become ever more essential as technology advances. Adults once memorized the Pythagorean theorem, the atomic numbers of carbon, and the functions of the Fourth Amendment. Today, those facts fit comfortably in children's pockets. So, too, does the full range of humanity's history, art, opinions, and lies. To thrive in such a world, kids will have to be able to make sense of it all, discerning what's true, what's useful, and what's relevant to their lives. It's the same lesson we'd eventually learn in Pittsburgh. At about the time that Google was briefing its statisticians, a group of parents and educators here were conducting a sort of ox Project Oxygen of their own. Greg had invited them out to breakfast to think through some difficult questions. In a time of rapid, remarkable change, what and how should children learn? What's relevant? What's engaging? What matters? The breakfast started small, a few teachers and parents getting together for pancakes and coffee. Eventually, they started bringing their friends, and then their friends brought friends of their own. Soon, the breakfast became standing meetings, growing in size and scope. Scientists, gamers, artists, and others started showing up, trading stories and discussing their fields. They talked about what interested them, what led them to their work, what moved them. They talked about their own joys and struggles with learning, the strength that had gotten them through life, and the things they wished they'd known earlier. Most of all, they talked about their childhoods. A certain theme emerged. When these adults, people who are thriving in the world by almost any measure, consider the substance of their formative years, none mention the hours spent drilling for exams. None had found their life's purpose in a state standard. The content they'd acquired had surely played a role, but their true moments of learning and definition had little to do with memorized facts or mandatory seat time. Instead, they'd been inspired by an incredible teacher. They'd fallen in love with a novel or the way paint spread on a canvas. Or they'd been asked a question that upended their world, sparking lifelong search for answers. Nearly everyone who joined us could trace their success to specific skills and mindsets, curiosity, creativity, communication, and more. Emerging learning science suggests that they were onto something. And over time, it became the group's mission to prove these tools using the new ways of learning available to modern kids. That mission would take the group through countless classrooms, the labs of leading learning scientists, and even the White House. The network we formed, Remake Learning, would grow to include thousands of parents, educators, libraries, universities, museums, and others working to make learning more engaging, more relevant, and more equitable. Its family-friendly festival, Remake Learning Days, would take root across our city, our region, and eventually our country. But in the beginning, our question was where to start. Fortunately, there was someone watching over us, a neighbor who'd spent a lifetime showing us the way. Remaking the neighborhood. With its stilts and costumes and songs, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood sometimes resembled children's games. Rogers himself was once asked why his educational television program didn't focus on facts, on letters and numbers, fractions and spelling. "I would rather give children the tools for learning," he responded. "If we give them the tools, they'll want to learn the facts. More importantly, they'll use the facts to build and not destroy." This is a book about how Rogers managed to do so and how his modern-day equivalents are working to do the same. Using the latest technology of his time, Rogers honored what was timeless and classic about being a kid, while also providing the same tools for learning that scientists now consider critical. The skills and mindsets he taught have been shown to boost everything from academic learning to children's well-being. They've been shown to be up to 10 times more predictive of long-term success than test scores, and they can benefit kids of every background and age. They cost next to nothing to develop, and they hinge on the very things that make life worthwhile: self-acceptance, close, loving relationships, and a deep regard for one's neighbor. "What ultimately matters," Rogers once wrote, "isn't how a person's inner life finally puts together the alphabet and numbers of his outer life. What really matters is whether he uses the alphabet for the declaration of a war or the description of a sunrise. His numbers for the final count at Buchenwald or the specifics of a brand new bridge." The neighborhood may be off the air, but its lessons are as relevant as ever. To thrive in the age of the algorithm, kids today, and their parents too, will have to excel at what Rogers taught best, being human.